Lecture 8, Legendary Kings and Heroes.
In this lecture, I plan to conclude the discussion of the cultural and religious background of Scandinavia in the Viking Age. In this particular lecture, I want to concentrate on the earliest heroes of Scandinavia who are celebrated in the traditional verse I spoke about in the previous two lectures. These would be heroes associated with eventually the kingdoms of Denmark and Sweden. And this lecture is an important transition into the Viking Age for several reasons. The heroes date from the 6th and 7th century AD, and in many ways they were not only examples to emulate, such as the legendary figures Gunnar and Sigurd from the Volsung saga, or the great gods Thor and Odin, who were told in the myths. These were figures who were historical characters. They were actually kings who ruled in what later came to be Sweden, Norway, and Denmark. And so these figures had a dual influence on the later Viking Age. One is, yes, they were great heroes. They were someone you would emulate. And they, in turn, were probably emulating the heroes before them. But on the other hand, they also became associated with the great halls at Lidar or Herat, which is on the island of Zealand, or Zealand as we say in English, which is the largest Danish island, and therefore acted as a model for the later kings of Denmark, who came to unite the kingdom of Denmark and in many ways saw themselves as the heirs to these not only to the courage and the deeds, but also to the political legacy of these early kings of Denmark. The same is true with a group of heroes and kings who are known from the area of central Sweden, who are associated at Uppsala, which continued to be a great sanctuary through the Viking Age and probably was still operating as a pagan sanctuary into the early 12th century AD. That was associated with another line of kings, the Ynglinga, or the Yingling kings, who claimed to be associated with the god Frey, the god of prosperity, the god of the other life associated with boars. And there was a great hall there, especially remembered with the rather avaricious and nasty king Adals, who's the opponent of Rolf Krake, the great king in Denmark, who's at the hall at Lidar. And finally, there is a memory of heroes who would become associated with eventually what became the basis of the Kingdom of Norway, even though today that area is part of Sweden. And these would be the so-called West Gotor or Gautar, the Geates of the Old English poem Beowulf, and the hero Beowulf, who's, while not really remembered in the Scandinavian tradition, is part of yet another political legacy that fed into the creation of the Kingdom of Norway. So what the legends give us, and these would be legends covering events from roughly about 490 AD to maybe 700 AD, is not only another version and insight into this heroic ethos, but also a window into some of the political geography that is beginning to take place in Scandinavia on the eve of the Viking Age, as well as the types of sea kings, and I prefer to call them sea kings rather than chiefs, who would launch the great Viking attacks. Now, what these figures don't have in the 6th and 7th century are the ships that will be capable of conducting those Viking raids. And we will discuss the ship technology in an upcoming lecture. And that ship technology is going to essentially be revolutionary in its military and political implications, and eventually even in its economic implications. These legendary figures in Scandinavia in the 6th and 7th century, the earliest Scandinavian heroes to be celebrated in poem and later in saga, are still dwelling in a world where ships have not yet progressed to the sleek longships of the Viking Age. And a good deal of the trade, as far as we can tell, from the surviving archaeological evidence, is really in the hands of Frisians, that is, the West Germanic peoples settled along the islands of Holland, who are under the protection of the Frankish kings and carry out most of the carrying trade between the Frankish world and England and Scandinavia in this period. Well, how do we know about these legendary figures of the 6th and 7th century, who came to be regarded in some ways as the first kings of Denmark, Sweden, and Norway? Well, we have some rather unusual sources on this. One is that Old English epic of Beowulf, which I mentioned in another context. Beowulf is a very peculiar poem. It is based on oral poetic techniques. That is, it goes back to the early dramatic poetry. But it was created as a literary masterpiece. It was written by a man probably living in a monastery of noble birth. It's an anonymous composition. It uses the old English techniques, but it was written as a single epic in which he took really probably three or four stories and combined them using probably the Aeneid of Virgil, the great Roman epic, as his model. It is also imbued with various Christian ideas. Beowulf is set in pagan Scandinavia, but this English author, being a Christian, probably his family had been Christians at this point for maybe one or two generations, has updated it religiously so that references to the ancient gods are removed, although the action and the ethos in the poem is very, very pagan indeed in many ways. That epic, which was perhaps composed in its current form somewhere around 725 AD, survives on a single manuscript that goes back to the Cotton Library, which is a very important library established in the early modern age. And the poem does reflect events in Scandinavia in some ways more faithfully than the later Norse traditions. The ancestors of the English who carried these traditions over to England came from a Scandinavia that had not yet coalesced into anything remotely looking like the kingdoms of Norway, Sweden, and Denmark. And therefore, they remember the Geatas, or the Gotar, as an independent group, dwelling on what is now the western shore of Sweden, which historically was associated with Norway and only become part of Sweden under a treaty in 1658. And that is the homeland of Beowulf, which is often referred to as West Gautland, the Western Goths. It's pretty much around, it's just north of the modern river Gota that feeds into Lake Vänern and hooks around towards the Oslo Fjord. So that Beowulf's kingdom, where he lived in, say, 500 AD, that of his lord Heislik, was really in some ways the eventual political basis for the Norwegian kingdom that grew up around the Oslo Fjord and the uplands. They also remember the fact that the Swedes, the Svear, Swede actually is an Anglo-Saxon rendition of the Norse name of these people, dwelled around Uppsala, that they lived around Lake Mälaren, and that much of what is now Sweden was divided up into independent tribes and peoples. And there was great distance separating the Swedes from the Danes, who are primarily located on the island of Zealand. Jutland, the peninsula that most people associate with Denmark at this point, was probably home to a whole bunch of different tribes that had very little to do with the Danes. The information that comes from the Norse sources is much later. It comes from Icelandic tradition. There were a number of poems associated with the heroes of this period, but these poems are usually quoted within prose narrative sagas. The most famous of them is the saga of Rolf Kraki, written in the 13th century AD. And the saga of Rolf Kraki talks about the same figures that you have in Beowulf. There are two significant differences between these accounts. Beowulf is talking about figures among the Danes and the Swedes, probably from the first half of the 6th century AD. The saga of Rolf Kraki concentrates on the generation after, on the king Rolf Kraki, who ruled at Hleidar, the great hall of Zealand, who was obviously the favorite of Odin, who was in many ways the model king for later Danish kings that would like to think of themselves as descendants of this king in Zealand one way or the other, or at least to his political legacy. Nonetheless, he is only a tangential figure in Beowulf's account. He isn't very important in the poem of Beowulf. He's only mentioned in passing because Beowulf is really more interested in the Gautish hero, the Gautar hero, the Gothic hero from what is now, you know, what the Scandinavians would have called Norway, as well as the Danes of that generation. There are a number of chronicles that have come down to us in Latin, written by Danish authors, and legendary histories. And the most important one that I'll mention quite frequently in this course, which is a major source not only for this period but running through the whole Viking Age, is a chronicle written by an ecclesiastical historian by the name of Saxo Grammaticus, a Danish cleric writing in the age of Valdemar I, who was Christian king of Denmark from 1157 to 1182, and in many ways made the Danish medieval kingdom a great kingdom in the 12th century. And Valdemar presided over a very important literary revival in Denmark, in which there was a great deal of composition in Latin, in which these Danish Christian kings are trying to project themselves as the Christian heirs of the kings going back to Rolf Krake and earlier, the so-called Skjoldingar, or the Skjolding kings of Denmark, that is, of the family of Rolf Krake. Well, that means that the Norse accounts are written without the same benefit of political geography of Beowulf. Beowulf is actually much closer to the very, very broken and fragmented political geography that must have existed in Scandinavia before the Viking Age, where Denmark, Norway, and Sweden at best were an embryo. Whereas the Norse accounts writing of these heroes have cast these heroes already into, well, this is the king of Denmark, Rolf Krake. This is going to be the king of Norway. They are thinking already in the classic three kingdoms, which are really a result of the Viking Age rather than a cause. The realm of Beowulf, which is along the western shores of Sweden today, north of the so-called Gota River, and bordering on the shore, is also borne out in the archaeology as a royal center. There are a number of important and impressive barrows, some early runestones from the area. It clearly was the center of royal power. Beowulf himself is never really remembered in the Norse tradition. The best guess is that he is represented as Bothvar Bjarki, who is a hero at the court of Rolf Krake, who is said to be a Norwegian. By the time the Norse authors wrote, the region which was Gotland in Beowulf's time in the 6th century had long passed under the control of largely Norway, some of it under Sweden. And so Beowulf is remembered as a berserker at the court of Rolf Krake, or a part of this legendary figure who fights in the form of a great bear. He has actually two brothers who are part animals as well. It's a really wild and rather woolly group that comes out of Norway to serve the Danish king. What we can tell is that already in the 6th century on the island of Zeelen, both the Anglo-Saxon and the Norse sources really agree there was a powerful kingdom ruled on that island from kings at this great hall, which in many ways was probably seen as the equivalent of Valhalla. It's called Heorot in the Anglo-Saxon tradition, or Hleidar in the Danish tradition. And in many ways, it is the predecessor of the later Christian capital of Roskilde. At the time, the legendary kings ruling there, the so-called Skjoldingar, or the Skjolding kings, the kings of the shield, traced their descent back to an eponymous hero who was supposed to be perhaps descended from Odin. Furthermore, these Danish rulers had very little control outside of the main island of Denmark. They may have exercised control in Skane. There's very little evidence that they ruled in Jutland. Their contemporaries and rivals were the Yngle kings of Sweden, who claimed descent from the god Frey and were remembered in the epics as great opponents. And again, archaeology does verify the fact that there is dense population settlements and graves around the Uppsala Lake Mälaren area on the island of Zealand, as well as, I've mentioned, the apparent heartland of Beowulf. So those three regions all end up becoming, interesting and significantly enough, the nucleus for the later Scandinavian kingdoms. In Beowulf, the legend and the action of the poem is really concentrated on this hero who travels to Denmark to rid the Danish hall Heorot of the horrid creature Grendel. And to the English poet, Scandinavia is a remote and misty land populated with Grendel, who's a monster who's never really very well described. There's been several suggestions of what his name means. It might be related to a Norse word of the blowing wind. There's another one where he's essentially translates as a bottom figure, bottom feeder. He's some creature from the depth. But in the Anglo-Saxon tradition, Beowulf fights Grendel, then Grendel's mother in these fantastic combats. He goes back to rule over his kingdom once his lord Heigelac is killed in a raid in Frisia and dies fighting a dragon, and a dragon that comes right out of Germanic mythology. As in all dragons, why do dragons get angry? Is someone stumbled into the lair and stole some of the gold treasure, so the dragon lashes out and Beowulf combats and fights this monster. So in the Anglo-Saxon tradition, while they do remember the names quite accurately in some ways and the kingdoms, this was all a fantastic legend. It's associated with great creatures and beasts from a primeval past. In the Norse tradition, the legends are quite different. Concentration is on human action, on great kings like Hrolf Kraki, who's the generation after Beowulf, or his rival in Sweden. There's conflicts between personalities. The kings attack each other and are trying to strive for gaining control of the great heroes of the Northland. Now, some of these elements are also in Beowulf, but they're not the primary action. And so the Norse saw these kingdoms in some ways as the prototypes for their, or I should say the Norse writers of the 12th and 13th century saw these kingdoms as sort of the prototypes for the kingdoms of their own days, the foundations of these later states. Hrolf Kraki, without a doubt, must have been a remarkable figure. He gave rise to a legendary figure remembered not only in Scandinavian tradition, but also in the Viking, in Anglo-Saxon tradition, but also in the Scandinavian tradition. He probably lived somewhere between 550 and 575 AD, and he was remembered in the tradition as one of the favorite of Odin. His great court was built around a oak tree, symbolic of Yggdrasil. He was, in turn, the son of a great figure who had been a Viking chief and a rather minor figure in the Beowulf poem. He's actually the result of an incestuous union between his father and his sister, Yrsa. The father marries the daughter in a rather complicated etiological myth. His father's name is Helgi, who is remembered also in the Anglo-Saxon tradition. What's important about Hrolf Kraki is he is the epitome of what not only a king of the Age of Migrations is, but also a king of the Viking Age. It is by his charisma, it is by his gift-giving, it is by his favor of Odin that he collects around him the greatest heroes of the Northland. And they come from different places, such as Bjarki from what is now Norway, Hjalti, Svipdag, a famous Swedish hero. Much of the traditions about Hrolf Kraki, and there would have been a very, very extensive poetic cycle in which poems would be recited, really concerned his heroes. And in many ways, Hrolf Kraki presided over his hall the way Odin presides over Valhalla. That is, Odin's hall is populated with all the great heroes of the past. He is waiting for the final day of doom, Ragnarok, and he keeps adding these heroes into his hall. And so Hrolf Kraki, in some ways, is presiding in Denmark in the way Odin presides in Asgard. So the result is numerous heroes and figures, many of them probably unrelated to Hrolf Kraki and even that period, get incorporated into this Danish legend, legendary king, and become part of the great group of retainers. In the era of the 6th and 7th century and in the Viking era, these men were probably known as berserkers. That is, the frenzied warriors who understood the power of runes and could work themselves up into battle rages, where they charged into battle without any regard for themselves. And the word still survives in English, to go berserk, that is, to go into a rage. And by the time you get to the 13th and 14th century, where Scandinavians are Christians, they kind of are a little standoffish on berserkers. This isn't really what you want to recommend. You're thinking more in terms of chivalrous knights, and berserkers don't really work out very well as chivalrous knights. And so in the prose accounts of the traditions of Hrolf Kraki, the berserkers become these crazy hero, these crazy warriors that the heroes like Hrolf Kraki or Bjarki actually defeat. And so they become sort of a class of strange opponents. And the berserkers of Hrolf Kraki's court then become heroes who are, you know, a little more respectable in Christian eyes. But they all probably were in this class of berserkers that are discussed in classical and medieval accounts of the professional warriors. Hrolf Kraki, remembered as a valiant king, clashed with his contemporary in Sweden, and that is a fellow by the name of Adals, who in the legend ends up marrying Hrolf Kraki's mother, Yrsa, who is actually also his half-sister in the myth. And there was a recollection in the myth, in the legend, that Hrolf Kraki had made a famous ride to Uppsala, that he had left his court at Hlidar, crossed over to what is now Sweden, Skane, and with his heroes galloped up to challenge the king of Uppsala. And the cause of this attack is a little obscure. It involves treasure, it involves honor, it involves some sort of dynastic issue. And this is what always sets the heroes off. Somehow their honor has been in one way or another sullied, and they have to assert it by going off and somehow besting their opponent in contests. In the saga of Ralph Krocki, Ralph travels through the forests of Sweden. And as I mentioned, that is probably a journey of at least a month to 6 weeks to ride from Denmark, you know, up to Uppsala. Along the way, he meets Odin, disguised as the farmer Ronnie. And Odin tests Ralf Krocki's warriors on various occasions. And when Ralf Krocki started out on this ride, he had his 12 champions, he had a bunch of berserkers and 100 other men. In the course of meeting Ronnie on several occasions, Ronnie keeps reappearing at new locations, which should have tipped Ralf Krocki off that this guy is not just an ordinary farmer, but, you know, it's a legend. We won't go into the details too much. And in each case, everyone fails but the 12 companions. And so the lesser men are dismissed and sent back to Denmark. And when Ralf Krocki emerges at Uppsala, he's only accompanied by his 12 warriors. And you're certainly not going to get much political history out of this, but you're certainly going to get a great deal of the social ethos and the warrior ethos in this tale. When they arrive in Uppsala, which would have been a great hall comparable to the one in Denmark, what Ralf Krocki and his men do is they move into this hall and take over. Ralf Krocki presides over the hall. There's Swedish warriors waiting to trap them. They slay them behind, they're hiding behind the tapestries. The Swedish king, Adils, has to run away. Rolf's mother comes out, presides over the hall. And what is established there is Ralf Krocki is a greater king. He's moved into the hall of his rival. He's taken it over. He presides over with his warriors. He starts giving gifts. He takes over the treasure of the Swedish king, who's known to be a miserly king, a man who doesn't win much loyalty to him. And as a result, he's usurped that position in Uppsala. Well, eventually, the Swedes come back. You know, Adils goes off and raises a huge army, and Rolf and his companions ride off to escape. In the course of their escape, they throw the gold they've captured across the fields of Uppsala. They sold the gold on Friesveller Plain, as it's called, and the Swedes jump down and fight over the gold, and the Danes gallop away. Well, it's an odd story to us, who think in terms of kingdoms and nation-states, perhaps, and we would think, well, this raid represented an attempt to assert the hegemony of the Danish, and there's all sorts of speculation about it. What it was a test of valor and the test of who was a greater king. It wasn't a question of taking territory. A great king was a man who attracted to him great warriors, who showed an example of generosity to those warriors, who could assure them of riches, and those riches were given out as gifts that honored not only the giver, but those who received. That is what makes Ralf Krocki a great hero. And the fact that he could move into the Swedish court and take over and preside in Sweden, just as he did in Denmark, is an indication that everyone agreed he is the greatest king of the Northlands. And yes, he does retreat. He does not stay in Uppsala. But the act of throwing the gold, in which the Swedes, you know, jump off their horses to fight the gold rather than pursue the Danes, is yet another indication to the Scandinavians who delighted in this story is Ralf Krocki has just bought the retainers of his rival Adils, who are now his retainers as much as they had been of the Swedish king. And that really captures the sense of what politically was important in the age of migration. Great kings who could go out on careers, gain riches, gain fame, build a great hall, attract the warriors to them. Kingship was something that you acquired due to your personal reputation and charisma. It was useful that you were descended from other kings, that you understood the profession of arms, that you had the favor of Odin. But kingship was only effective if it was made effective and exercised by that ruler. And that is an important point to stress because the Viking Age will give many men the possibilities to become sea kings and gain riches and powers and therefore establish their own kingdoms, whether overseas or later in Scandinavia. That notion is already evident probably in the clashes that you see among those incipient kingdoms in Scandinavia in the 6th century. It's that same world is captured very vividly in Beowulf in the boasting that goes on at the great halls, because halls, as I mentioned, were not only political centers where a king ruled, but there were also places where religious ceremonies took place. especially in the spring and early summer before the campaigning season, before Sea Kings would launch out on raids, before you would go attack the hall of your rival king to search your valor. You would have great ceremonies. There would be feasting. A lot of mead would pass around, and probably wine imported from the Carolingian world, and their boasts were made. And those boasts were extremely important. You raised your toast. You claimed what you were going to do. And when you made those claims, you swore it on rings, rings which would be associated with Odin. And then you had to deliver. And this sort of fellowship goes on in the Epic of Beowulf. It goes on in the sagas of Rolf Krake. And it continues as a theme even into early Christian times among Scandinavian kings. The most famous of them, we'll mention later, occurs somewhere shortly after 986 when these professional Vikings, the Yoms Vikings, show up at the Danish court and boast, well, we're going to punish Jarl or Earl Håkon of Norway because we're being hosted by our great king Sven Fjorkbeard. They swear all of these oaths and boasts in the great hall in this religious political ceremony. And then the next morning when everyone sobers up and the Joms Vikings are thinking, well, we must have had a great time. I can't remember what I said. Sven Fjorkbeard immediately reminds, don't you remember you swore on the rings, the Odin's rings, and you said you're going to sail to Norway and beat up King Håkon for me. And they say, oh yeah, I guess we did. And sure enough, off and running into one of the great naval disasters of Danish history. So these traditions are extremely powerful to the Scandinavians. When you're looking at these early legends of Beowulf and Rolf Krake, you're seeing the way politics are played out in the Viking Age. They're extremely personal. They're tied to great kings. Great kings make their reputation by going out raiding, by warring, great deeds as warriors. They acquire the wealth, the women, the warriors that allow them to establish a hall, and from that hall they rule as monarch over an area that is really rather vaguely defined. These are not kingdoms in any kind of Roman sense or medieval sense. They are very, very much personal monarchies, and they are personal monarchs who are very much motivated by issues of a personal honor, revenge, pride, all of those motives. And so the legends in the epic of Beowulf capture this aspect of political life far more effectively than any kind of modern analysis of what motivated these rulers. But what was the point in the importance of these legendary figures to the Viking Age? To some extent, they were added into that great hall of heroes going back to the Volsungs. They were seen as prototypes of what a king could be in Scandinavia. And they also reveal a very important point which is now being debated among scholars. I mentioned there's a revisionist scholarship that has taken the position that the Vikings in some ways have been greatly exaggerated. That they're essentially pirates. They're rather marginal to the development of Western Europe. Most of our information we have about them has been written by monks who are usually the victims of Viking raids. And these guys are generally rather hysterical, and they're bound to exaggerate 5 Viking ships into 50 ships. It is also pointed out that Western Europeans in both Anglo-Saxon England and Carolingian Europe were hardly models of Christian piety, that the warrior caste was pretty brutal. There are records of monasteries being sacked or damaged in battles among Christian warriors. And there's a great deal of truth to this, and there is a reason to accept some of these caveats. On the other hand, when you look at the legends and the myths, and particularly the legends associated with Rolf Krake, the Epic of Beowulf, the Scandinavians who launched out several generations later from when these epics are placed in time were not burdened with any notion of just war. To be sure, monasteries were sacked in Europe, but that was an outrageous crime and the exception and not the rule. The Western Europeans were in no way prepared for the types of warriors that would descend upon them in those longships. They are dealing with Scandinavians who see themselves as the emulators of these great heroes, who not only exceed all expectations in battle, they revel in battle. They go into battle with ecstatic joy. Whether they win or lose doesn't matter because they join the great hall of Odin. And honor, riches, entrance into Valhalla, this is what is going to motivate the Vikings more than anything else over the next 300 years. And battle, and in battle, success goes to those who have the will and determination to prevail. And with figures such as Odin, Sigurd, Rolf Krake, the Norse had in these heroes traditions which gave them the will to dominate battlefields, sweep away better and more numerous opponents, and the Western Europeans were really completely unprepared for the type of invasions they're about to experience.